This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Barbara King. She's a biological anthropologist at the College of William and Mary. She's the author of the book How Animals Grieve, and she will be giving a talk tomorrow, the 28th of April, from 6:30 to 7:30 on animal emotion. That's at the New Mexico History Museum, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here today.
Good to have you, and it's such an interesting topic. The subject, the whole field, like the scientific field of animal emotion, seems to have come a really long way just in the last generation or two. I mean, I think that it wasn't too long ago that scientists thought that animals didn't feel anything at all.
Well, that's true. Back in the day, Darwin, of course, knew that animals felt emotions. So in the 19th century, he was very much involved with the study of emotions, watching animals, observing what they do, how they express their emotions, writing about it. And then for a good part of the 20th century, there was a withdrawal of belief that, in fact, as you say, animals could really feel. So this is a real renaissance, and it really is very wide and sweeping, I think. They're not all scientists who agree, but there's a core of us who are really working very hard on this, a pretty large number, in fact. And part of the issue is really about whether we're being anthropomorphic or not.
Right.
And that's still a big debate.
Well, and that's something we can get into as we talk about this whole issue of grief. And as you write about in your book, How Animals Grieve, there is a kind of inextricable connection, or at least if that's how I understood it, between grief and love. Mm-hmm. Where there is grief, there has to have been love in the first place?
That's how I see it, at least in most cases. There are exceptions, but I'm talking about them as bound up very much with each other, and I want to use those words full on, rather than saying that animals have tight social bonds or animals experience a period of disruption after the death of someone they hung out with. I just want to use those words. And it helps me, I think, to get my point across, to suggest, just as it's true in our lives, when we love someone, we know that there's probably going to be a period of grief in our future. The same thing is true for many of our animal companions, depending on, again, what species and which individuals, because there's no written rules. There's so much variation, but as a rule across the board.
You start the book talking about domestic pets, cats, mm-hmm. and then dogs, and some cats and dogs really do grieve and others don't. How do we understand, first of all, what does the process look like when an animal is in a grief process?
I'll give you an example from my home state of Virginia. We have friends who live 10 miles from us who adopted two Siamese cat sisters who lived together then for 14 years. So Willa and Carson are the names of the two cats, and that's a nice resonance for
Willa Cather and Carson McCullough.
That's right. Okay. And then the time came when one of the two sisters had to be euthanized at the vet. And in fact, actually, now that I think about it, they were thinking about euthanasia, but she died in her sleep, interestingly. The other sister began to pace the home and to wail. My friend Karen, who described this to me, is a very literary person, as you can tell from the cat names, and she said that it sounded like keening, and that it just continued. And for people who might have suggested, oh, the survivor was just really responding to the human grief, this went on. So the sister who was left would go to places where she had lain entwined with her sister for 14 years, would stop there, would look, would be very sad. And this continued for a really long time. And if you think about it, it makes sense. This was the most important being in the world to her. I believe those two cats loved each other by any reasonable definition. So when one was left, this process went on. And the best thing that I have ever known to do in a situation like this for a pet is to bring a younger animal into the home after some period of time had passed. That's what my friends did. And that's the only thing that really revived the interest of this cat in living again. So it's sort of a funny story from my own house. My husband and I rescue cats. We have six who live with us in the house. 2 in our yard, and 9 more in a big spacious enclosure my husband built. So we had a death in one of our cats, and we were very sad, but we thought, okay, I've really learned something from this experience. Clearly these cats are bonded with each other, and we very ceremoniously got the body and put it out for the other cats to have their period of mourning, and they completely ignored the body. So I think the difference is that in our house, the cats are one-to-one connected to us more profoundly than they are connected to each other. There are no sister pairs. There are no friends who came in together. So when we want to understand who grieves for whom, it's the same questions we would raise in a human life. What is the relationship? What is the profound connection between them? What is the personality of the survivor? So we really go on a case-by-case basis to see who's doing what.
It's tricky because, I mean, some of it is the personality of the animals. I've had a couple of dogs die in the last few years, and I always put their bodies out so that the other dogs can sniff them and know that they're dead and so that they don't get confused about it. And when my dog Honey died, I had 2 dogs left. One of them was distraught and stayed away from the body, didn't even go into the room. The other one practically tripped over it and didn't care at all and seemed to think that it was basically an opportunity to get more room on the couch.
Yeah, sometimes I've done some radio call-in shows, and one woman called up and said, I just had a dog die, and the other dog doesn't care. What's wrong? You're saying that my dog should be grieving. And of course, I went on to say, well, there's no shoulds about grief for animals any more than there is for us. But in some cases, the survivor becomes elevated in the family and gets more attention, gets things that maybe were in short supply before, or it just may simply be a personality difference, as you say. I'm not sure it's true also, if I think about it, that we should expect there to be any particular trajectory of grief, even when, someone dies in our families. We don't know what's going on really behind closed doors and what kind of relationships people have. So grief is a really tricky thing. It's experienced very differently across individuals.
When animals lose their own children, are there any particular patterns to that? I mean, you talk about a lot of different kinds mm-hmm. of animals in your book. And for example, there's some primates and dolphins, when they lose their children, go into a state.
Yeah, I have studied monkeys and apes, our closest primate kin, for very many years. And what we find is often a mother who has lost an infant will continue to carry that infant long after you would think this would be a reasonable thing to do. So this mom is carrying around what's essentially a mummified corpse, if you will. And the question that really arises from this is, why? Can this really be grief? Is there full awareness that the child has died? What is happening? In a particular site in Ethiopia, one of my former students, Peter Fashing, has found that gelada monkeys, in fact, mothers will clasp the infant sort of to their body, but go on feeding and grooming, even mating while that's happening. That does not look like grief. What is going on? Is this possession? Is it something about this object now belongs to me? There's been a transition in the animal's mind that this is no longer a living infant. In other cases, we see real affect on the part of apes, emotion, distress, social withdrawal during the time that the infant's being carried, and we can more readily say, this is coupled with a mourning response. Dolphin mothers will often keep their dead infants buoyed up in the water through considerable energetic cost to themselves for many days. What we know about dolphin cognition certainly suggests that these moms would be aware that their child is not moving, that there is a change in state, that they must be doing something that they're aware of, that they're buoying up a dead infant. Sometimes there are as many as 16 dolphins that spell the mother and help keep this infant up in the water. But again, it's so hard to know because we're really asking about an internal state. So for my definition of grief to apply, I really need to know how the animals were acting before a death, after a death, and really be able to look at some visible expression of emotion. That's hard to do with animals like dolphins. We live in a watery world so different than ours.
It's interesting because it brings up the question, do animals know what death is? Mm-hmm. As you say in your book, ants know what death is. They have a ritual for carrying off a dead mm-hmm. ant. There's not a whole lot of evidence that ants really have emotion about it, although who knows what ant emotion might be like. But then there are really questions in other animals whether they recognize death as a thing.
Yes, you know, as an anthropologist, I'm always saying that I want to walk a fine line between acknowledging and studying these incredible continuities across species. Wow, grief and love, and we feel these things, and we're all sort of one on this earth. But also saying humans do things differently. We, of course, know that we'll die. We know that those who love us will die, and that makes life sweeter in a way, as well as sometimes harder. I don't see it as an enormous burden of awareness as it is sort of adding a richness to life. But we grieve linguistically, we grieve culturally, we grieve with this incredible sort of brain awareness. Is there evidence that other animals do this? One zoo worker told me a story about a gorilla male who grieved quite visibly when his partner of many years died. So the zoo allowed him to approach the body and did all the right things in giving him time to notice and grieve and sit with the body. But at first he tried to revive his partner, a female who had died of cancer, and even brought celery and tried to stuff it into her hand. At that point, we can understand that he does not really know what death is. He then turned, let out a very loud wail, and banged on the cage bars and stopped trying to revive her and stopped trying to give her treasured objects. My question is could that have been a moment of intense recognition where there was a switch in his mind from, you know, what has happened to, she's gone? That doesn't necessarily mean he would think of death with the finality that we would, or have a concept of death. But perhaps it does indicate that other minds, elephants, primates, dolphins, can grasp in some way the finality of that absence.
One of the things that has happened in animal research is that a bunch of chimpanzees were taught sign language. Have any of those chimpanzees that learn sign language been asked about death?
Yes, apes, orangutans, and chimpanzees were taught what I like to call aspects of American Sign Language, and I do this out of respect for the deaf community, because ASL is a full language where people are able to, of course, talk about the past and the present and create poetry. And the apes that were taught signs of American Sign Language could not do that. They couldn't use ASL any more than they could speak in German, but they could, of course, put together phrases. Now, there are some abstractions that these apes are able to use. They can certainly talk about good and bad. And I know that the very famous anecdote of Coco the gorilla is about the loss of her kitten. I'm a little bit skeptical. There hasn't been what I would consider to be strong enough evidence to really contextualize these utterances. So at this point, I don't think we really have a good answer to that question.
We're talking to Barbara King about animal emotion and how animals grieve. I think it's really interesting to think about these questions, you know, as a scientist, for you and for the many anthropologists and other kinds of scientists that you work with, because there are a lot of traits that we have that are adaptive, and we look for adaptive significance in our traits, both physical and emotional and so on. Is grieving adaptive? Is it the opposite?
I'm asked this all the time, and I only wish I had a really fantastic and interesting answer. I don't think we know. The whole field of animal thanatology is absolutely in its infancy. When I started out to research how animals grieve, I knew I would find examples from chimpanzees, dolphins, and elephants. What I didn't expect was to find examples in birds and in farmed animals. So we don't really know much about this topic. One possibility is that grief allows a survivor time to recover and reorganize. This very consistent pattern that I'm finding is social withdrawal at the time of a death that someone is grieving, whether this be a baboon or a duck. So during the period of social withdrawal, the animal is no longer taking pleasure in socializing in ways that she or he did before. And perhaps that period is really a time to experience fatigue, to let the brain reorganize, to let the sort of shock of the death sort of settle in much the way that one of us might withdraw from our social circles after a death. And it just gives us time for repair. Another possibility, though, is, again, going back to my theme of the entangled nature of grief and of love, is that it's simply a byproduct of love, that it is not adaptive, that it's love that's adaptive, and that what we suffer as a result of loving is a completely non-adaptive process. And if you think about it, how are we ever going to test between these things? One way to do it might be to look and see in pair-bonded birds or pair-bonded mammals to correlate the strength of a grief response with the health, the mental and physical health of the survivor going forward. Is there something adaptive about taking that time to withdraw versus perhaps not? It's complicated by the fact that I would predict natural selection to work against very much visible evidence of grief in wild animals.
Yeah, because then they become easy prey.
Right. It's dinner for the lion, the hyena, the raptor, whatever. So I think that, in fact, when we find examples that are very clearly grief by my definition, we're really underestimating what might be felt internally because we're being conservative and working in what can be seen. And surely that's going to be worked against by the forces of evolution for the reasons that you say.
Do you think that humans grieve more than any other kind of animal? Are we more vulnerable to grief?
I don't think we are more vulnerable. I think we grieve differently. I think, from what I have researched, that the grief that animals may feel can be searing, and I would not feel comfortable trying to rank that along any continuum of more or deeper. But the difference may be that we are able to grieve across time and space. We grieve for people we've never met. We grieve for people who lived in other time periods outside our immediate community. I always use examples of traveling the world and going to very famous monuments that may be in Manhattan, or it may be in Hiroshima, it may be in Rwanda. And when we're there, we feel for people we haven't met. I believe that is a grief response if we feel it deeply enough, in any case. And so animals don't seem to have that generalized response to grieving. The closest I've found is in elephants. There's a very wonderful scientific paper that I'll be talking about tomorrow night that suggests a bit of a generalized grief response in elephants, but not to the degree that we do. Also, I read very widely in the grief memoir genre. We write our grief, we dance our grief, we make plays and art out of our grief. So it is a different process. I don't think it's necessarily a deeper or a quote-unquote more process.
Tell us more about elephants and their grieving process.
Elephants are fascinating because they're long-lived. They live in family groups, and as I'm sure you know, elephants are led by females, so they're old matriarchs. And the matriarchs may bond with each other across family groups. And there does seem to be a response that, at least as far as the data I'm aware, is female-centered. If a female is ill or dying or has died, the response seems to come not just from her children, but from other females, other matriarchs, who are very aware and very attuned. And this may continue for days after a matriarch has died. And this refers to the paper in Samburu National Park in Kenya that I'll be talking about tomorrow night. And in a way, elephants are the touchstone for us because we have repeated examples where in Amboseli, where I did my doctoral dissertation on baboons, not elephants, we know that they divert their path when they're walking across the savannah, elephant families, and come upon bones and stroke the bones, move the bones, caress the bones. And if you are the elephant researcher, Cynthia Moss, who knows these elephants, she can say, ah, that is the kin of the elephant, you know, who used to own these bones, feeling the bones. They somehow do things that we don't understand. How do they know when they're crossing? Do they have a mental map of where the bones were? Do they somehow recognize? We have answered questions with elephants and unanswered questions so that it sparks our imagination and helps us know what to look for in other species. This is not to say that other species will be like elephants, but, you know, we can only see what's out there in nature if we open our mind to the possibilities, and that's what elephants help us do.
What is the adaptive significance or advantage of love? And what do we even mean by love?
Yes, if I could define love right. for you, I'd be a very happy person. What I am meaning by love really is when two individuals or more in a family context or a group context choose to spend time together for reasons that go way beyond survival. You know, they're not just feeding together or picking off ticks and grooming together, but they're doing something together by choice. Now, this is even problematic right away because you could ask me, well, how does that fit for a mom and an infant? I mean, the infant doesn't have a choice. The infant is suckling off the mom in mammals. How do we know that they're making a choice? But I'm really talking about a long-term profound connection where there is great distress if that bond is disrupted, not necessarily just through death, but through some sort of absence or separation that may occur. So, I mean, if you look at mammals, we can see that this love is adaptive in the maternal infant context, in the mating context, but, you know, we also now don't shy away from the word friends. We know that there are animal friendships. These animals choose to be together outside of mating, outside of feeding, outside of grooming. What is that line between friendship and love? That's the question that's not so much being asked. I was interviewed for the New York Times about animal friendship, and a whole bunch of scientists got together, and we all said, sure, animals have friendships. But I don't think we're comfortable yet in being able to parse apart that line between friendship and love. But I would ask you, can we do that in our own relationships? Can we always right. tell sometimes friendships overlap with love, sometimes they don't? These are not questions that are any easier to answer in animals than they are in our own lives.
Well, one of our journalistic colleagues recently died, and his memorial service was packed with grieving people who loved this young man. I mean, love and friendship are something that I think we take for granted, or maybe we've just become more open over the years to our own feelings of love for our friends. But I mean, I think it's interesting that there are not only animal friends, but as you point out, and as the internet is rife with, examples of interspecies friendship in yes. animals. There was one going around, I think it was a goat and a donkey, and they got separated and then they were brought back together because one of them got so depressed that they brought the other, somehow, they, I don't know why they got separated, they brought the other one back and it became happy again. And these are things that perhaps don't have any adaptive reason. It's just that we already know how to love through evolution and it just happens?
It spills over. I think yeah. we, meaning most animals, not all animals, but most are, in a sense, wired to love. And if there isn't an individual of your own species, or even if there is sometimes, I mean, who knows? Yeah, there's all kinds of stories of interspecies love. And, you know, what I've been, you may want to talk about this later, I don't know, but what I've been trying to do with all this is to say, not only is this fascinating scientifically because it tells us more about our own place in the world and how connected we really are to nature, but now that we know this, now that we know animals are friends, that animals love and animals grieve, what do we do about it as a society? How do we begin to think differently about our relationship with animals? And to me, that is the real payoff in doing this kind of work, because it allows you to start thinking about working for animals and not just on animals.
So what's your feeling on that? What's your take on it? How can we and should we look at things differently and do things differently?
I have changed a lot in how I go about my life, I suppose you'd say, in the last 5 to 10 years as I've gotten more heavily into this work, in that I don't go to entertainment parks where cetaceans, whales, and dolphins are made to perform. I eat very differently. I don't eat meat very much, if at all. I really don't eat much meat at all. And I'm getting closer and closer to the vegetarian vegan end of the spectrum. I have spoken out on the Hill in Washington, D.C. and other places in my writing about the use of monkeys and apes in biomedical laboratories. And why? It's because it's all connected, not just to sort of a cold calculus of are we being ethical, but because I understand that it's not just when an animal dies that there's all this emotion. If we have animals kept in biomedical laboratories and they're observing these constant knockdown procedures of animals being taken away and having invasive experiments on them, they feel that. They empathize. They worry. They grieve when that other animal doesn't come back into the cage next door. When there's a cow whose calf is taken away from her year after year, and she's wailing because her child is taken away from her. When, in fact, this is what happens when cetaceans are kept in theme parks, the mother and the calves are separated. These are emotions that cascade not only to the individual experiencing them, but to the whole family. So I think it's good not to go around and say to other people, look, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to stop eating this, you need to stop eating that. That is not my message, but rather that if we can collectively begin to link up the animal emotions that we're beginning to really understand scientifically with the issues of animal welfare and animal rights that face us in this country, that linkage is going to move us forward in how we think about these issues.
Do you think that there are ways of raising animals for food that aren't cruel?
I am struggling right now with the concept of humane slaughter. I have a number of colleagues who tell me quite concretely and convincingly that the term is an oxymoron, that there's no way to have humane slaughter simply because we're dealing with, in the case of pigs and chickens and cows, sentient animals who wish to live, that their lives matter to them as much as our lives matter to us. On the other hand, I speak also to people who have small farms, small farmers who care very much about their animals and who ensure that their lives are good lives, that the chickens and the pigs and the cows are not kept, of course, in factory farm horrible conditions, but are living outside in the fresh air and in the green grass and are treated well and are then slaughtered. So the question becomes, is it okay to say, wonderful life, one bad day, being the day of slaughter, or is it not? This is a question that I'm struggling with, and I'm very suspicious, honestly, of people on either side of this question who feel that they have it all worked out. I think it's a really complex matter. I admire vegan activists, at least the ones who are peaceful and in dialogue, and at the same time, I don't see the world becoming vegan. I think it is, in many cases, a matter of privilege for those of us who can decide what we eat and have the resources to make those choices. So I am very leery about imposing any particular way of being on anyone else, and I just think we need a lot more dialogue across different factions on these issues.
Do you have a different set of feelings about hunting than so-called humane slaughter? In other words, hunting has been in our past since we were hunter-gatherers.
One thing that I find difficult about certain discourse around food in this country is when people say our evolutionary past was, after all, peaceful and vegetarian, and we may have gone through a brief period of hunting, but we really didn't. But no, we really became human because we are meat eaters, and we hunted perhaps not for 99% of our history. That is a factoid that I don't believe is true. We only started hunting, say, 500,000 years ago. But hunting and meeting was very, very important. It allowed the brain to grow. It reshaped our bodies and our brains. But having said that, I think our future is very much predicated on what we do with that empathetic big brain, that now that we have produced this by evolutionary processes, we need to use it and to think about different ways of relating, and hunting comes in there. I have people, again, whom I respect, telling me that hunting is a less cruel way of going about certain types of wildlife management. For example, with populations that would suffer slow starvation deaths during winters versus culling. That is a hard issue. I could not be a hunter. I could not do that. But I don't want to also take on this Disneyfied view of nature where we just leave everybody alone and then we may in fact be ending up causing harm to animals by not managing their populations.
Well, I mean, if we were to take a truly natural view of nature and let it be what it is, there would be wolves, coyotes, and other predators eating the deer herds that are out of control because those predators have been exterminated.
Yes, and it's very interesting to see the changes that are happening at Yellowstone, the cascading changes since the reintroduction of the wolves, and how that is reshaping the landscape in so many ways. And what does it mean now that we're having so many urban predators? You know, we find coyotes, you know, just sort of prowling off down the streets of Chicago. And why is that? Because we have been invading and shrinking their territories, they're coming into our cities. These are incredibly fascinating and complex questions. The next book that is coming out in January takes up some of these questions about our food systems. And I'm also in conversation with a lot of people who are thinking and writing about these. And my answer is always, again, the same, that we need to be talking more so that we can understand that there aren't any easy answers.
We're talking to Barbara King about her book, How Animals Grieve. I think it's interesting in this whole understanding of love and friendship in animals that, I mean, you write about this yourself, people watching them have really become more open to feeling and expressing and writing in terms of their own emotion and their own empathy with respect to animals.
I would say yes, and I would also say no. I write for National Public Radio every Thursday, and I often write about animal emotions, and there's still a significant proportion of the population that does wield that A word, anthropomorphism, the projection of human qualities onto other animals. So there is a lot of worry still about this, and my response is that there's good anthropomorphism and bad anthropomorphism. I think that the suggestion that love and grief are human emotions is interesting in the first place, right? It can only be anthropomorphic if we're projecting what we sort of own onto other animals, but we don't own love and grief. On the other hand, when more complex terms are thrown around, such as jealousy, you know, very easily, it's possible to turn on even a purportedly good science program and hear, well, the here is a monkey dynamic going on, and this sister is clearly jealous of that one. We have to be very careful about how we use those words. I try to be conservative and rigorous because I want to have credibility when I do wield these words of emotions. So it depends on the degree of anthropomorphism, and it depends on the context. So there's a great divide, I think, in people on this topic. There's a lot of people who still aren't comfortable with this projection of emotions.
When you say bad anthropomorphism, what I flash to is terriers dressed in ballet tutus and pictures of them all over the place, and people trying to make their pets into little sort of weak humans and not letting dogs be dogs and cats be cats.
That's very funny because one of the slides I'll project tomorrow night speaks exactly to that. It's a dressed up dog and with a collar, a ruffle collar, and it's dressed up like a human. Yes. And we have such a strange relationship with animals in this country because, as you know, the pet industry is multi-multi-million dollar, and it's not just feeding and caring for animals, but, you know, how can we send them to a spa, a day spa, so the dogs can be with their friends? How can we dress them up at Halloween? And at the same time, we have so many animals languishing in our shelters who need to be spay-neutered, who need to be adopted. And that's a hard thing to wrap my head around. We love our animals, and at the same time, we neglect our animals. We love animals, and we eat animals. So it's very multi-layered, and that's part of what I'm thinking about as an anthropologist, that human behavior is never simple.
One thing that's interesting is that love in the animal kingdom, pretty much across the board, if I understood your book correctly, really doesn't have much to do with monogamy, and monogamy is pretty rare.
It's certainly rare in primates, the group of animals that I've myself studied and know best, perhaps less rare in birds, so it depends on the taxa that we're talking about. The work that Bernd Heinrich has done on ravens and crows, for example, tells us that there can be really strongly felt bird losses because birds pair bond and they come to know each other as individuals. So sometimes it does have to do with monogamy. Other times, one of the examples I'll talk about tomorrow night involves a marmoset family with a mated male and female, and one of them dies, and I'll reveal what happens tomorrow night. But so sometimes yes and sometimes no, but certainly you're right to suggest that it spans a number of social organizations and mating contexts beyond just monogamy.
Do you have any advice for our listeners who might have a grieving pet?
Well, the answer to grief is love, in that sort of continuous entanglement, and most people will know that without my telling them. I think what I do when I am working with a grieving animal is just shower that animal with more attention, hugs, strokes, whatever's appropriate for the animal. And depending on what's going on in my family at the time, if this death has left the animal alone in the sense of the same species to which the animal belongs, I do think about waiting a certain period of time and then bringing in another animal, or even importing a guest for the day. I know that some people, if a dog dies, they're not ready to get another dog, but they have a dog friend come over for the day. It seems to perk up the sort of mourning survivor. So I think that respecting the time period of social withdrawal and not trying to rush it, but then taking small steps to bring the animal back into the sort of social fold is the best that I know to do.
Barbara King is a biological anthropologist at the College of William and Mary. She's author of several books, including How Animals Grieve. And once again, she'll be talking tomorrow, the 28th of April, at 6:30 on animal emotion at the New Mexico History Museum, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, you can go to sarweb.org. Barbara, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed our talk so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design. This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at StudioX.com.